How's everybody doing? What's that? I don't know how to interpret that. Last day of classes and we're here. That could mean you're doing terrible. It could mean you're doing great. It is the last day of this class. I'm going to try to keep myself together emotionally. How's Tiny Box coming? Who met the spec? Yeah. Only one? Some hesitancy on maybe met the spec, maybe two? How many people got their converter to run the full power? Larger number. How many people got their converter to run, period? All right.
It converts power.
Into heat? Any general comments on it, questions?
I don't like TPC's packaging. GAN system is far superior as far as soldering and troubleshooting. I don't like it. I've told Edward that Edward Jones works for him. I'm trying to get vocal about it.
Okay, as long as they're aware of the feedback and can incorporate that into future planning. Okay. Yeah, it's somewhat of a developed skill soldering those.
Yes, for machines.
PCB layout continues to be of the utmost importance in power electronics.
You switch multiple power supplies, yeah. These parasitics can really cause issues.
Gate driver circuitry should not be overlooked.
Gate drivers, important. I agree.
For Windows 10, downloading and installing Xilinx was kind of
Is it really that much of a pain?
You have to like change a bunch of the library files.
Really?
Yeah, the DLL files download from Windows 10. I have those specific ones.
Huh. But
I mean, the LinkedIn percent had a how-to guide. But it wasn't intuitive.
Okay. That's something I'll have to look into. I didn't know that was going to be.
It's just Vado,
no problem in Windows 10.
Yeah.
It has been there.
ISV's not really supported.
Yeah, a couple of years ago they stopped support there. Okay, I'll have to look into that for future years. Maybe we just have that installed on some machines and ready to go, or something else. Are there comments or feedback? Straw poll, worthwhile? Did you learn something? Getting a lot of reserved positive nods. Okay. Okay. Well, I appreciate your feedback. Another opportunity for feedback is through the anonymous course evaluation. Please do fill that out. We're up to 79% completion. Wednesday is the last day that you can go online and fill that out. So please do that prior to Wednesday. Give me feedback on TinyBox, on the course in general. Or I appreciate and feel free to give the feedback outside of this as well. If you want to just come talk to me or send me an email, anything else. Tell me that. Okay, so it is the last lecture. Based on site visit issues, we talked about this schedule, so I will send out the final by email on Friday. It'll be posted to the website, password protected, and I'll send out an email any information and a password to access that. And then it'll be due a week from Friday by 10:10. Normal class time. Okay. Sometime before the end of the day, Friday, December 14th, please return to my office, the FPGA interface board, any spare components for that interface board, your converters and your components are yours to keep, but those FPGAs and interface boards, I need back. And there'll be some portion of your grade on the tiny box challenge associated with that. It'll be 100% if you turn it all in, 0% if you don't, just to incentivize that. Any other questions regarding logistics of the remainder of the course? No? Okay. Then plan for the remainder of lecture today is to finish covering a couple issues related to discrete time modeling and then conclude the course. So last class, we kind of quickly went over discrete time modeling. You're showing historical perspective, compared that to average modeling, noted that under some simplifying assumptions, this discrete time formulation reduces down to the averaging formulation. And those assumptions included things like, okay, all of my dx dt, all of my derivatives on my states are straight line during every interval, and all of my dynamics are really slow in the system. If that's not true, which is going to be the case in things like resonant converters, switch capacitor converters, most of the things we've been looking at in this course, then average modeling isn't going to apply. Those assumptions aren't going to be valid. Thus, why we went away from it right at the beginning of the course and started developing things like state space averaging, state plane analysis, sinusoidal approximation, charge vector analysis for switch caps, which is a slight modification. And then eventually discrete time modeling. So the formulation here for discrete time modeling looks at just solving the state space equation, which is essentially using a generalized matrix form, but really all we're doing is writing the differential equations for the converter and then solving them to get the exact behavior of it. So we do that using state space so that we get matrix equations so that it can be general to n different differential equations if I have n states and inductors and capacitors over some number of switching subintervals. Here I'm showing two, but this could be 15 different switching subintervals. Doesn't matter. All of these products and sums are going to multiply out. So the nice thing about this is the method is agnostic to whatever is going on in the converter itself. As long as I can write these A and B matrices, which is mathematically equivalent to saying I can sketch the circuit schematic in each subinterval. Right? It's just saying what's connected to what that defines the equations in that subinterval. As long as I can write those, then I can solve through this. It doesn't matter. I don't have the same requirements for approximation that I have in some of the other methods we've looked at. State plane, I needed zero loss. Doesn't matter if there's resistors in here. Sinusoidal analysis, I needed single frequency resonance. Doesn't matter if there's 100 different resonant frequencies in this. All just falls through. So, in mind, the general form for any number of states, any number of switching subintervals looks like this. And solving it in this way is why it falls out as discrete time analysis, and that we are solving for the states at the end of the interval from the states at the beginning of the switching period in a single expression. So we're kind of jumping between each period, just solving from the states at the beginning, the states at the end, then the next period, those will be our new initial states, solve the next period, so on and so forth. It becomes a discrete time system sampled at the switching frequency. Solve for the states once every period. Now in this formulation it looks like that. I can then solve for the states at any given time just by backing out through these equations. These equations are all valid at any time. But to get something periodic, I'm solving in discrete time sampled at the switching period. Okay, so there's a difference between discrete and average. This slide shows what I kind of sketched briefly at the end of class last time, that I can take this equation and solve for the steady state solution simply by saying x of 0 and x of ts, the states at the beginning and end of a switching period, should be equal when the converter operates in periodic steady state. So if I set both of those equal to the same thing, I can solve for x of 0, which is equal to x of ts. And it looks like this. Just subtract this product over to the left, then multiply both sides by the inverse. And now this is a general solution for steady state operation for an arbitrary switched circuit. Which is quite useful. So the last topic I want to talk about on this is small signal modeling, how to get dynamic equations that can be used for control design. And then we'll show a couple examples of application of discrete time modeling. Okay. So going back to our general plot here, where I have just some arbitrary state progressing through a two switching subinterval circuit, which is a buck converter, has some dynamics in the first subinterval defined by A1 and B1, some dynamics in the second subinterval defined by A2 and B2. This could be inductor current, capacitor voltage, whatever, it's just one of the six. So if I want to look at what happens in response to perturbations in my control, that's really what I'm looking at for small signal modeling of my controlled output transfer function. Really what we're going to be trying to do is find this here. Small signal, my system now, my discrete time system is linear with respect to states and inputs. My small signal model is going to have phi and psi, the same matrices as coefficients of x hat and u hat. But I need to figure out what this gamma times v hat is. Small signal, what are the dynamics of the system? How does it respond to perturbations in duty cycle? Okay. For a buck converter, this would be duty cycle. If I go to one of our resonant converters, it might be switching frequency. Either way, the method's going to be the same. Okay, so what's going to happen if I do a very small perturbation in duty cycle? Right? So I have this first subinterval is of duration dTs. This one is d prime Ts. So if I perturb duty cycle a little bit, let's say I decrease d to be now capital D plus d hat. What's going to happen? Well, here's my perturbation, d hat ts. So by perturbing that duty cycle, what happens is my states now stay in this first subinterval a little bit longer, and then they're going to go through the second subinterval a little bit shorter amount of time. So we have fixed switching frequency. Right? If I change duty cycle, I spend a higher percent of the period in the first subinterval than the second compared to my steady state. So for small signal modeling, what I'm looking at is the small signal difference in response to a small signal perturbation in duty cycle. So I have this small perturbation in duty cycle, and I want to know, okay, what is my x hat? How much did my states change in response to that? And the idea behind small signal modeling, I'm looking at extremely small perturbations. So diagrammed it out here with some finite non-zero width. But I'm really looking at almost a zero width, the limit as that perturbation and duty cycle goes to zero. So it's infinitesimally small perturbation. So, well, how do I solve x hat? I'm going to do that by saying kind of a two-step solution. First, I want to solve what this is. I believe I'll call this xd hat. So how much different are the states right as a result of that perturbation? And then x hat is just going to be that difference propagated through this subinterval. I'll have this difference, and then it goes through all of subinterval 2. And I know how to model states propagating through the subinterval. That's how we built the discrete time formulation to begin with. Okay, so Here's what that looks like. XD hat is this perturbation in the state. Then my X hat, the difference between my steady state solution and my perturbed solution at the end of the period, is just going to be XD hat propagated through subinterval 2, which is this matrix exponential e to the at times that difference. Okay. Now, how do we get XD hat? So this answer is built on the idea that this is an infinitesimally small perturbation. So at an infinitesimally small scale, everything is linear, right? Even though the large signal dynamics through each of these subintervals are nonlinear and there could be resonances and other things, if I look really close at any given state waveform, it's going to be linear over a very small time. Okay? So if I have a really small d hat, then I can model the difference between what happens when I stay in subinterval 1 versus what happens when I go into subinterval 2 as just slope times time. It's linear. So slope in subinterval 1 is ax plus bu. It's defined by the state space equation. Slope in subinterval 2 is ax plus bu, a2 and b2. And I just do the difference between them. That's the difference in states right here. Okay. Does that make sense? That equation? So then I take that whole thing, that is this, plug it in there. That'll give me x hat as a function of d hat, which is the gamma I'm looking for. So if I plug that in, then gamma is those two things rearranged a little bit, just collecting terms. Those this should be, excuse me, x d hat. Excuse me, no, it's not. That's an incorrect modification. Because that xd hat has already been divided out, goes into x hat, this xd, and to say is that this is the steady state solution. Capital XD is whatever the states were at this perturbation time in steady state, and that is the linearization around our DC operating point or steady state operating point. Plug in the steady state. Because this is a small signal model, it's valid only for small perturbations around that steady state operating point, which is defined by XD. Capital. Okay. So then we have a complete discrete time small signal model. And we can things like solve for a z-domain controlled output transfer function. Doing so for one example converter is shown on the next couple slides, taken from a textbook shown down here at the bottom. So this is, there's a buck converter with some parasitic resistances in series with the output cap and in series with the inductor. And then the plot here compares average modeling to discrete time modeling up to half the switching frequency here. So this is a 1 megahertz converter, 500K is half the switching period. What do we see comparing these two? Well, up to about a decade below the switching frequency, almost no difference in the magnitude and a little bit of discrepancy in the phase. That kind of conforms to our rule of thumb that average model is good as long as your crossover frequency is below a decade below the switching frequency, right? And it's because the averaging model begins to become inaccurate as you approach the switching frequency. Ending on model that could be closer or further off. Discrete time model generally is comparing two models here, but the difference between them analytically is only the approximations made in the average model, which we know are invalid. They're just approximations to get a simple result. We treat the discrete time model as kind of the accurate behavior of the circuit. The average model, any difference between the two is just error. So if I tried to run up and put a bandwidth of the circuit approaching half the switching frequency, I design something, say, okay, I've got a really good phase margin, and in fact, my phase is almost 180 degrees lower than, yeah, what I predicted. Right. So the discrete time transfer function is going to be CZI minus E inverse times D, right? Or times B plus D, right? Same thing as what you would do to convert from state space to a transfer function, right? That gives you a GVD of Z, right? Still in discrete time. Then you can either direct design with that, which is really a better way to do it, because you, particularly if you have digital control, you prefer to have a discrete time transfer function because you're going to be sampling and designing in discrete time anyway. That's beyond the scope of this course to talk about digital control. So here, you just do a continuous to, or a discrete to continuous conversion of that using whatever method you like. Right? It's not going to particularly influence. Yeah. So there's some discrepancy there. Part of it has to do with some model delay in the feedback loop, assuming however output voltage is sensing and fed back, there's some time delay in that, and that'll contribute to this discrepancy. That can be modeled along with the average model by just putting delay in the transfer function. Put a e to the TDS term in there, which will model some sampling and transport delay. If you do that, then the comparison looks like this. Adding, so the discrete time model is unchanged. The average model are just multiplied by this delay term. Things get quite a bit closer, right? And the average model is more or less a good prediction up to maybe a quarter of the switching frequency. Which almost seems like that's really the only effect going on. The issue here, though, the reason this is able to match up so well is because we're looking at a specific transfer function in a buck converter. The buck converter is designed to be relatively small ripple, and the buck converter has this nice structure where really it's not all that nonlinear as far as power converters go. The reason for that functionally is just buck converter. I think the first thing you learn in power electronics is this buck converter works by creating a square wave and then filtering it down. So I have a nice separation of what's going on with the passives and what's going on with the switches, and could equally well model a buck converter instead of a bunch of internal states switching around as just an input, which is a square wave, and then a filter after it. So it has this property called topological time invariance, which means that the topology itself isn't really changing as you switch. All it's changing is the input. It's a square wave input and then a filter. Versus most other converters, something like a boost, things are moving around. You don't have this separation of here's the switches and here's the filters. Okay. The way that we can then demonstrate that even with delay, you don't solve all the problems, even including delay, is by looking at a different transfer function, even in the buck converter. So here, looking at the control to current transfer function, that no longer has this nice, okay, just switch and then filter. Inductor behavior actually is integrated with switching behavior. You can see the average model, even with delay, significantly different than the discrete time model, even back at low frequencies. It's not just that behavior as you approach the switching frequency that gets distorted. The things can alias down even to DC by neglecting some of these high frequency behaviors that eventually get rectified and alter the behavior of the converter. Okay. So the reason this comes up here in the control to inductor current transfer function is because it's looking at current mode control, which has dependence on exactly what's going on at a given time. So this current mode control, you haven't seen it, means the duty cycle is not set explicitly. We switch whenever the current reaches a reference, which means that the behavior of that system is heavily dependent on the exact time that the current hits that reference. Okay. So those high frequency behaviors matter. Will alter if they're not modeled when it switches and what the steady state solution is. In fact, analysis of current mode control, really a lot of the motivation behind developing this at the time, more so than resonant behaviors, more so than high frequency switching effects. It was this current mode control really can't be modeled with an average circuit well. Discrete time model, and model it very accurately. Okay. So, recap, discrete time analysis. We have this sort of equation solving for the steady state, and then this analytical method we can use to solve for things like arbitrarily any kind of time progression of what's going on with the states and also small signal models. And we can do that with only really one approximation, which is that U is constant or slowly varying. It's the only direct approximation we needed to make. Everything else is just solved. Okay? There are some requirements to be able to apply this, not necessarily approximations. They don't limit its accuracy, but they just need to be there in order to have it work. And this one, we talked about these two, really the ones that I want to highlight here. So for this to work, I need to be able to plug in the time duration of every switching subinterval. And this question was asked last class, but what happens if I have something like DCM or something like a dead time of any of the resonant converters we've looked at? If the dead time goes too long, the diode turns on, right? So any sort of uncontrolled switching, like you might get based on a diode, there's say switching that is controlled by the value of a voltage or current rather than by a control signal, you may not know these times a priori. You might have to have some analysis and say, okay, what is the actual diode conduction time? And it makes it a little more difficult to just plug in right. And then this last one about his baseline assumption for all this is that every subinterval can be described as a passive linear circuit. That is limiting in that we can't natively include nonlinear behaviors like core loss, like frequency dependent resistances, simply. Okay. Now, there's for the most part no other method that can, right? Even with any of our other averaging state plane analysis, with all of those, if we had something like core loss, we'd solve assuming no core loss, and then after the fact, compute core loss based on the waveforms. This is so-called high efficiency approximation. Assume those losses are small. The waveforms are going to look pretty much the same as they would if those losses weren't there, so I'll just calculate them after the fact. That's going to be true here as well. Nonlinearities, the beauty of this will fall apart. Okay. But with those three in mind, you can do all this. I don't have to have any dedicated analysis of the converter other than just describing the topology itself, writing down A and B, which, as I said, is akin to just sketching a schematic in a mathematical way. One potential issue with this, I'll go into a lot, is that you do lose some of the design-oriented analysis that you get with other methods, right? State plane analysis, sketching these plots, helps build intuition as to what's going on in the converter. kind of get a feel for how the resonances are working, where the linear intervals are, what things should look like. Plugging this in, I can take a topology that I have no idea how it works, write these equations, plug in and get an answer. Won't have that same level of intuition developed though. Okay. Here's what the steady state states are, and I get a vector of numbers, and I have no idea how this thing operates still. So it does fall short relative to some of these other metrics in building that design-oriented analysis, building understanding as you're analyzing the convert. So quickly, just a couple examples here. From this reference down at the bottom was the design of a dual active bridge for 150 to 12 volt, 120 watts at 1 megahertz, tested to 98% efficiency. Validation, DAB, we've talked about extensively in this class. To look at the necessity for discrete time modeling, I compare between looking at a selective averaging model, where I say neglect anything about the device capacitances or resonances, just look at straight line waveforms. And if I do direct average modeling, everything in the tank is going to average to zero and I'm going to get nothing happening. So what I do is average only at the output. So I assume the inductor current still looks like this straight line model, and my output current looks like this straight line rectified version of it, and then average this thing to get the dynamic behavior of the circuit. That's going to be my comparison to show why you need to do discrete time modeling. So if I include the behavior of these capacitances, obviously things aren't going to be straight line anymore. I'm going to have resonances at each switching time. Okay. And here, just trying to see if I can model this thing with an average model. Shown here for the primary bridge voltage, output voltage, and inductor current, what they look like at a steady state operating point over the primary side switching time, the inductor current ramping interval, and then the secondary side switching time. So these are all one continuous waveform, just split by which interval we're in. And if this could be modeled with average modeling reduces from discrete time modeling by approximating these matrices as just their first order Taylor series expansion, I plus AT. So for each subinterval, I replaced this exponential with I plus AT and then plotted from the beginning of the period what the waveforms would look like as predicted by a model which assumes straight line ripple in each subinterval. Okay, you can see these green lines are not a good prediction of most states. So some of them model particularly things like the primary bridge voltage in the intervals where it's not changing are well approximated as straight line. The inductor current during this phase shift interval where it linearly ramps up or down, well approximated as straight line, well during the power delivery interval. I can keep going there and say, okay, what if I did the Taylor series expansions of the second order? That now picks up a couple more states and a couple more subintervals. These two, the red is a pretty good match to the blue, my whole dynamics of the system. This one, it's kind of close, not great, and these two, it's still terrible. Okay. Why these ones? Well, this is my dead time. This is when I have this high frequency resonance, which allows me to get zero voltage switching. This is the most non-straight line interval. And that's not well modeled unless I consider the full dynamics of the system using something like discrete time modeling or state plane analysis. Okay. So this thing, I went and did state plane analysis, and here's all the equations for it. We have the two state planes. And then also over a wide range of operation, the operating modes change depending on whether I have hard switching or a phase shift less than zero or a phase shift less than zero and hard switching. Each of those result in a different state plane and a different set of equations describing the operation, which is all of these. And using all that state plane analysis, able to get a model that matches up pretty well. I might have shown this earlier in the course. just operation and high power and low power, loss model versus measurements, and then measured versus analytical state plane at full power match up fairly well. So that all worked pretty well. What I want to make is state plane analysis gives some understanding of what's going on. And if I can look at these different state planes, kind of understand the behaviors of the circuit and why I get some different resonances and different operating modes. But what it ended up resulting in analytically is a bunch of systems of equations that I can't really look at and determine anything about what's going on. And I'm still just solving these numerically ways we've been doing in class. Okay, so there's a question of, was that really worth it when I could, across all of these operating modes, just use this single equation and solve for the steady state behavior and the dynamic behavior of this converter using discrete time analysis. Here's the show. So I write down those matrices that describe the subinterval equivalent circuits and just plug in. Here's the discrete time model matching up to time domain waveforms for the inductor current and output voltage at a couple different operating points. I'll show these. Just want to kind of go back to what is the discrete time model. Well, it's a sampled model that's going to model the behavior of the states only at fixed times synchronous with the switching frequency. See here. Here I'm modeling more or less the peak current everywhere, and that's because there's not a lot of changes in the inductor current dynamics. But over here at the high power operating point, I have some transient here in load. And you can see I go from modeling the peak current to modeling some other portion of the current. Because the top of this trapezoidal inductor current, because this load transient goes from sloping up to sloping down, so I'm still always modeling the inductor current at the end of that power delivery interval. So it's actually very accurate. It's tracking the value of that state at the end of that switching period, but you need to be cognizant of what this is actually modeling. It's modeling just the states at a specific time. It's not an envelope model, not an average model. Modeling just what is the state at this time right before I go into the phase shift interval. That matches up real well. Output voltage being small ripple. Don't have to worry about some of those things. Inductor current being AC in my AC link dual active bridge. Ripple is significant, so it's going to model the time output voltage. Maybe spikes are really just measurement noise. It's more or less just the average value of it. Okay. So it can predict all those dynamics and also match up to measurements. So the blue line is the discrete time model, black line are measurements. This purple line is what I would get if I stuck with that average model that I showed, just neglecting any of the resonances. Probably this is a better way. It's not gonna work. I just stuck with this model here where I neglect the resonance, make it really easy by just averaging the output current. What I end up with is this purple line. See, does not model the dynamics of the system very well at all, even back at DC. Purple line really just looks like the average current feeding the output capacitor, looks like some integrator. Minus 90 degrees of phase, and minus 20 dB per decade across the whole thing. Okay. The existence of those EVS intervals has some internal feedback that causes things to not just look like a pure integrator that isn't modeled unless you look at those intervals. Okay. So nice thing there, across all these different operating modes, the discrete time model stays valid. It also stays valid across different topologies, whether I'm talking about AC link type topologies or switch cap or hybrid switch cap or quasi resonant or multi resonant or back to PWM, all of them reduced down to this equation under the assumptions we talked about. So has a lot of utility in that it is quite general. The issue with approaching things with discrete time analysis and why this isn't kind of the first and only way that we teach is that it doesn't have, as I was mentioning before, that same level of design intuition. You can plug things in, you get a result. As long as you did it correctly, that result is very accurate. But you may not learn a lot about what's going on in this converter in the process of doing that. It doesn't really build intuition the same way sketching a state plane. So there are some ways, this is more of a research topic, of gaining back some of that intuition. So if I can approximate the dynamics within any subinterval as I plus AT, just the first order Taylor series expansion, that's the same thing as average modeling. As we know, average modeling will result in nice equations that you can look at and say, okay, the Q of this resonance is L over R. So I know if I want lower Q, I need smaller L, higher R. Look at those equations and understand the behavior. Discrete time modeling, generally, you have this big product of matrix exponentials that you can't resolve analytically, you just get numerically. So you can't say, okay, how does the inductance affect the behavior where this pole and zero are without more numerical methods. If I can approximate by this first order Taylor series expansion, that's something that I can then solve all those products and get an analytical expression. Right? But as I was motivating before, you can't do that, right? It's not accurate. However, it was accurate sometimes. Okay, these four intervals were accurate. And in the discrete time model, I'm going to go through each subinterval and solve the jump in each subinterval from the states at the beginning to the states at the end. So I can select which ones I can approximate as linear and go ahead and plug those in. Then put a little more effort on these subintervals that are highly resonant and solve them in a different way. Based on time, I'm not going to really go into this in detail, but for this dual active ridge, it was just this resonant interval. I can replace the discrete time formulation of that with just some dedicated modeling of what's going on in that resonance. I have to look at it specifically and write some equations and figure out, okay, over this interval, how much does each stage change and what does that depend on? But plugging that in and getting rid of the one non-straight line interval, I can get a separate matrix to replace and then eventually get something that is closed form analytical. So it's possible to take this and go back to something to get analytical equations back out of it, but it requires some effort, some staring at things, and some figuring out how to model it. Where is a linear, a straight line approximation valid, and where is it not? Okay, and that remains accurate even despite cutting those intervals out. This is just an example of modeling a switch cap converter to motivate the generality of it. Okay, I'm going to skip that and talk here. So here's the three assumptions that we talked about. Just want to have my slides work. There you are. Okay, the inputs DC are slowly varying. Talked about that's a pretty valid assumption to make for a switch mode power supply. This is a DC to DC converter. My input should be DC or slowly varying with respect to switching frequency. In almost all instances where that might be violated, it can be resolved by just modeling out wider. So if you have, for example, a non-DC input because it's being supplied by a switch mode converter with ripple, then you just need to model out further and model these two converters together as one. If you keep expanding your model, eventually you should go back to something that's DC or slowly varying. So that tends to not be such a problem. This all subinterval times are known, however, as I mentioned, even something as simple as a buck converter, if I want to model this, including the effects of, say it's a quasi-square wave buck converter, what's going on at the switch node, I'd have three subintervals. The switch is on, I get this thing. When the diode's on, I get this thing. And when both are off during the dead time, I get this circuit. And I solve that out and just guess at what the dead time is. I give it the dead time I programmed into my buck converter controller. And what I'll get is potentially a solution that looks like this, where during the dead time, the switch node voltage goes negative. Now that can't happen in the buck converter because of this body diode, But during that time, I'm modeling using the both off equivalent subcircuit, which doesn't have that diode. So in this circuit here, no problem, this voltage goes negative, right? So the problem is I need to know exactly what that dead time is before the body diode turns on so that the switch node voltage can't go negative. And I'd have to, in some way, figure out how to adjust the time so that switch node voltage doesn't go negative in order for this model to be valid. That can be done iteratively by checking and revising the times that you plug in. And then the last one they talked about, nonlinear losses, principle one being switching losses due to a variety of mechanisms. However, these can be incorporated in the same way that we do in many different models, using things like a double pulse test, and then using the high efficiency approximation to say the waveforms are what they are, and then just add in the double pulse test loss results as an example. Okay, that's everything on discrete time modeling. My last few minutes, I'm just gonna offer some conclusions on the course. I'm gonna motivate from this plot here. Looks at, for example, in a design of some power converter, as I begin looking at the design of that and changing variables around, changing device selection, switching frequency and inductance, looking at the performance of each of those, in general, get some trade-off between the size and the efficiency. Depending on what my design is motivated by, I might look at more axes here, cost, reliability, other things. Right? Switching frequency is one knob that we have to turn to alter the design space point of our converter. Generally, just looking at this black line, if I take some low frequency, low switching frequency design, should be highly efficient, have small switching losses, but to get that, I'm gonna need really big passive components. As I start increasing the switching frequency, going this way on that curve, I'm gonna get less efficient for a comparable design. I'm switching faster, whatever switching losses I had are gonna go up. But I can make the thing smaller and get higher power density. And that'll continue up and up until a point where my efficiency gets so low that this thing is overheating, I need to put a big heat sink on it, something like that. So there's a limited degree to which increasing the switching frequency helps me. And how far I wanna go in that direction really depends on my design, only as far as I absolutely have to. This is something we said on the first day of the course. I named this course High Frequency Power Electronics because at the time I couldn't think of a better name. No other reason. How high frequency should you go in a switch mode converter? Only ever as high as this is advantageous to what you're trying to achieve. So if I need higher power density, I might track down this curve some direction. Okay. So this red might, or the black might be some baseline design. Red might now be my quasi-square wave design. Allows me to get out to higher power density, some smaller passive devices, but I take some hidden efficiency. Blue might be some design with a bunch of parallel devices where I get smaller but can get to higher efficiency. Fundamentally, everything's gonna have this eventual trade-off. And that's what we looked at in problem 3 of the midterm, other places. Is even if I go to something that's soft switching and assume there are zero switching losses left, things still reflect back down. I still can't push this thing infinitely. Okay. If I go to a quasi square wave implementation, I get rid of a lot of switching losses, but I have higher RMS currents. So as I keep pushing and pushing that, eventually those higher RMS currents are gonna be the limiting factor for my converter. Whereas in a hard switch implementation, it might just be the switching loss. It's just showing that effect. What's the limitation? Well, for soft switch converters, as I go higher and higher switching frequency, eventually the overhead, the dead times, the time that it takes me to make sure I keep ZVS begins to affect my RMS currents, increasing my peaks, increasing my conduction losses, and still reflects down. So there's still a limited degree to which playing with the switching frequency is going to help me improve the behavior of the circuit. That is all I have. Thank you for all your hard work throughout the semester. It's been a pleasure. Good luck with your finals. Good luck to all of us surviving site visit. Feel free to contact me if you have any questions through the remainder of the course. Otherwise, we'll have the final coming out at the end of the week. And please return your hardware from Tiny Box Challenge. Thanks, guys.